as many of you know, this autumn we are learning once again be alongside our children and youth in church school, a curriculum called Seeking Peace Together. We're now in about the seventh or eighth week of it. And this week's theme is Isaac and his neighbors, or if you read the blog this week, you might call it Walking Away. We're hearing today from the first book of the Bible, Genesis. It's a little known story about Isaac, the only story we get really of him as an adult. And it tells us a lot about his character. And it's a little bit long and complicated. So I'm going to invite you to sit back and just take it in and pretend you're out somewhere in the desert in ancient Israel around the fire hearing this story. So Isaac is living in the land of Gerar amid the Philistines. Isaac planted crops in that land and took in a huge harvest, and God blessed him. Isaac got richer and richer by the day until he was very wealthy. He accumulated flocks and herds and many, many servants. So much so that his Philistine neighbors began to envy him. They got back at him by throwing dirt and debris into all the wells that his father's servants had dug back in the days of his father Abraham, and this was clogging up all the wells. Finally, the Philistine king Abimelech said to Isaac, "Leave. You've become far too big for us." So Isaac left. And he camped in the valley of Gerar and settled down there. And Isaac dug again the wells which were dug in the days of his father Abraham, but had been clogged up by the Philistines after Abraham's death. And Isaac renamed the wells, using the original names his father had given them. One day, as Isaac's servants were digging in the valley, they came upon a well of spring water. And the shepherds around them, the ones who herded their sheep in the valley of Gerar, quarreled with Isaac's shepherds, claiming, "This water is ours." So Isaac named the well Esek, which means quarrel, because they quarreled over this well. So they dug another well, and there was a difference over that one also. So he named it Sitna, which means accusation. And he went on there and dug yet another well. But there was no fighting over this third well. And so he named it Rehoboth, which means wide open space, saying, "Now God has given us plenty of space to spread out in the land." From there, Isaac went to Beersheba, and that very night God appeared to Isaac and said, "I am the God of Abraham, your father. Don't fear a thing because I am with you. I'll bless you and I'll make your children flourish because of Abraham, my servant." And so Isaac built an altar there, and he prayed, calling on God by name. And he pitched his tent, and his servants started digging another well. And then King Abimelech of the Philistines came to him from Gerar with Azuzath, his advisor, and Phicol, the head of his troops. And Isaac asked them, "Why did you come to me? You hate me. You threw me out of your country." And they said, "We realized that God is on your side, and we'd like to make a deal between us, a covenant, that we maintain friendly relations. We haven't bothered you in the past. We treated you kindly, and we let you leave us in peace. So God's blessing be with you." And Isaac laid out a feast, and they ate and drank together. And then early in the morning, they exchanged oaths to one another. And then Isaac said goodbye, and they parted as friends. And later that same day, Isaac's servants came to him with the news about the well they had been digging. "We struck water," they said. And Isaac named that well Sheba, which means oath. And that's the name of the city to this very day, Beersheba, Oath Well. The stories and wisdom of God for the people of God. Let us pray. God, as we join Isaac and his servants among the desert sands of the Near East, as we hear about him digging wells, we ask that you would bring a wellspring of life to us, that we may seek and understand, that we may know when it's time to walk away and when it's time to lean in, that the words of our mouths and the meditations of all our hearts may be truly acceptable in your sight. O God, our rock and our redeemer, let the people say. Now, if you're like me, you may listen to that story and think, what is that all about? Anyone confused by this story? No? You all get it? Okay, well, you can preach then, it's fine. I have to say, I had to read it two or three times before I could really understand what was going on in this text. Now, as I said, we're following the church curriculum, which is about seeking peace together. And part of the reason you may know we do this routinely is because we would love to foster intergenerational conversations so that what the kids are learning in church school, you can talk about at the breakfast table, the dinner table, on your way home from church and say, what did you get out of church today? And how might we live this with our lives? So that's our intention here. I will say sometimes when I get these assignments from these curriculum, I feel like I don't know if I want this assignment for preaching. And that was part of how I approached it this week. I happen to know the woman who wrote the curriculum. She's a Mennonite colleague of mine in Kansas, and I texted her this week and I said, did you have any other scripture verses you were considering for this? She texted back about when Jesus accepted his sentencing and went to crucifixion. I said, I don't want to preach on that this week. We'll save that for Holy Week. Now, the text is about water rights in the Near East. But like a lot of stories, that's what it's over, but it's not what it's about, right? It has some resonance as you watch the news these days because it's about land rights, right? And it's not lost on me that Gerar, where this is happening, is only 9 miles from Gaza City currently. It's also not lost on me that later in King David's time, that the Philistines lived in what is now the Gaza Strip. So there is this resonance of how this has geopolitical resonance even in our lives today. But I want to talk about a little bit more from a personal level. As many of you know, I really enjoy preaching on the patriarchs and matriarchs of the story of Genesis because they're a lot more like us. They are petty, and they are jealous, and they have egos, and they mess up, and then they apologize, sometimes, sometimes not. They're conniving, they get it right, they get it wrong. And I identify with a lot of their shenanigans in my own personality. When I preach on Jesus, I'm like, Jesus, you're so perfect. Jesus, as I've said before, is who I want to be like, who I think we're all trying to be more like. The matriarchs and patriarchs are more what we're really like and what the world is like when we read about them. Except that Isaac in this story is a little more Jesus-like in what he does. It's true that, and I'd say he's even a little different than Jesus would be, because Jesus never shied away from a good conflict. Jesus was willing to get into the argument with them and do this kind of rhetorical jiu-jitsu where he would help them understand the fallacy of their argument. Isaac does not do that. He just walks away from the situation. Just a little bit about Isaac. So Isaac is the middle generation in this story. You know, his father Abraham was the founder of the faith. His son Jacob was this conniver who, word has it, when he and his twin were born, he was grasping at the heel of his twin because he wanted to be first, and that's why his name Yaakov means the grabber or the supplanter. And Isaac is often overshadowed by his father and his son. I think of how we think of middle child syndrome, sort of often in the middle and either ignored or not leaning in. That's sort of like Isaac in the middle generation. And this is the one story where we get anything about his character. We will remember, if you go back a few chapters, of how his father attempted to sacrifice him, like a lamb to slaughter, one of the troubling stories of this whole book. And it was a sort of seen as a test of Abraham's faith, and just as he was to raise the sword, God said, stop. And Isaac, from all we can tell from that story, went into it fairly willingly and just followed his father's instruction. We also, as we heard 2 weeks ago, when Jeff portrayed our Isaac right up here, and Myers tried to trick him out of his, to get his birthright as the son Jacob, we know that story and how Isaac was tricked. And we might assume from these stories that Isaac was really a chump, just easily deceived, easily brought into dangerous situations. Except now in this story, Isaac is a really successful rancher with lots of flocks and herds and servants. And the lesson that Joanna wants us to take out of this is that sometimes when it's necessary or prudent, being a peacemaker means to walk away from a conflict. Sometimes it is necessary and prudent that to be a peacemaker means walking away from a conflict. This is a really unique take on this passage. I couldn't find it in any commentaries or Jewish midrash or rabbinical sermons. And the key turn in the story is when it says, finally, King Abimelech says to Isaac, leave. You've become far too big for us. And Isaac left. Now, between those two sentences, I think a lot went on, right? There must have been some discussions. I believe if you were Isaac's wife, Rebecca, you want to say, we're what? We're just leaving? All the herds and servants, if you were some of the top servants, you would be asking, we're doing what? If you were Esau, who was still around, Jacob had flown the coop by this time, but if you were Esau, you're like, Dad, wait, we're doing what? We're moving on? These are our wells. My grandfather, Abraham, gave us these wells. We have a right to them. I imagine they went back and forth with some fairly passionate discussions before walking away. I'm reminded of when Michelle Obama told the Democratic National Convention, when they go low, we go high, which is a great aphorism for us to stick to. I later heard her interviewed saying, believe me, I go low just in the company of trusted friends before I can go high publicly. And I think that may have happened with Isaac and his family. You can imagine, just to try to think how this might work in every day, we think of water rights in the Near East as so vital in that dry and parched land. But I'm aware this morning I turned on the kitchen sink, flushed the toilet, turned on the shower, did a load of laundry this weekend, did the dishes. Water is a source of life for all of us, and we often, in this modern culture, take it for granted. You only have to turn on the news or go not too deeply in the internet to see how water rights around the world are becoming very contested and dangerous and no longer an assumed right for a lot of people in the world. Water is vital to every one of us. And you can imagine if someone started messing with your water supply, cutting it off from you, you would take action, right? You would get upset. A few years ago, I discovered there was a sinkhole in our patio that was getting bigger and bigger. Turned out we had a 100-year-old sewer pipe that was failing. And then also, I noticed the water pressure in our house was going down, and it turned out we needed a new water main. Now, we happened to be zoned in a part of Cambridge, a very small part of Cambridge, where that is all our responsibility as abutters, not the city's responsibility. And as we started hiring and contracting, one of my neighbors actually has done a lot of work with the city, and he said, yeah, we're gonna have to pay for this. $40,000. Now, I would have been ready to have a fight, right? And say, no, how can this be? Where's this law? Well, my neighbor looked it up, and he said, it is not worth the fight for us, Kent. He said, this is the rules, and this is how it plays out. Fortunately, we had four or five abutters. We all worked together. We came up with the money to pay for it. Thanks be to God, we were able to do that, and hopefully it will last long after we're dead. But just a little example of, I still think we could have fought, and we could fight the city. Maybe we should fight when it's not so red hot to benefit other people. But I have to ask, what is it worth to my own time and effort, my own resources in hiring legal help and consultants and advisors, right? I also wondered another way we might think about these wells in modern circumstances is if your parents had left you a pile of money in a trust or a community foundation that you were relying on as a passive income stream, and someone started messing with it and messing around with your relationships with the bank and access to these funds, identity theft perhaps,
you would be up for a fight. And it would be reasonable. In this case, Isaac did not fight. He just left. Why? Why does it matter? And what does it mean for you and me today? You may remember that in mid-March, when we were looking at the Psalms, we, as a part of our Lenten study, we looked at a psalm about anger and the role of anger in our lives and in our faith. And I quoted to you a story that's been sticking with me about a Wall Street Journal correspondent in Chicago who got into a little fight with a bus driver about whether she had shown her pass or not. Anybody remember this? Yeah, Kate remembers, some other people. But the lesson that I drew from her story, and she said something inappropriate to him, someone on the bus said something humiliating to her, and she walked away and she sort of reassessed what she'd done and how she had acted badly. And part of what she reflected on is different types of anger. And she said there is ego-driven anger, which is about when our own person feels affronted or things are not going the way we think they should. And then there is justice-driven anger, when we get angry about things that affect the whole body, when water rights are being taken away from people or they're being oppressed or bombed into misery. That sort of justice anger is the anger that we want to lean more into and be more curious about the ego-driven anger. And I think that Isaac, in that moment, realized he has to be careful whether he is doing ego-driven conflict or justice-driven conflict. I imagine he did the calculus in his head, yes, my father dug these wells, but I think there's probably enough water in this desert for all of us. And I would rather be friends with the Philistines than to be their enemies. I'd rather think about the days when we may need their support and help than right now to get in quarrels. I invite you to consider thinking on a regular basis about when our actions are ego-driven and when they are justice or looking at the bigger whole. You can do this in plenty of ways. You can try it in traffic every day. When this person cut me off, am I going to lay on the horn? And who is that benefiting? Me, them, everyone around us? Or do I just need to accept this is part of driving in Massachusetts? You can think about it. That's a small way. You can think about it, the colleague who always hogs lots of airtime or picks fights. Am I going to get engaged and hooked into this every time? Or am I going to step back and look at the bigger picture and what's going on? God gives us plenty of opportunities to practice this in small and big ways. The stories we read about in the media are the ways that they conflagrate in big ways, where people never learn to do this in their personal or public lives. I'm also aware that Isaac being a little Jesus-like reminds me of when Jesus said, "You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of your Father in heaven." Now, granted, this doesn't work in all situations and all ways, which is why I think this is a very sophisticated lesson for our kids, our youth, and for us to try to grapple with. When is it right for me to lean in and engage, and when is it right for me to step away and do something else? If you look this up on Psychology Today about how to manage conflict, they'll tell you to look at two elements, substance and relationship. Is this really about water rights in the desert, or is this about survival and mutual support for one another? Is this really about me and the Philistines right in this current moment and who has the right to this well, or is it about us learning to get along? To support one or another in mutual ways for the long term, for the God's view of history term. Think about that in the conflicts we go about, that you and I go about during the week. What is the substance of this conflict? What is it over and what is it about? And what do I want to preserve here about the relationships? It's important to say that Isaac had the benefit of being a wealthy man. He also trusted God would help him provide. There would be plenty of more water in the region for him to sink into. He was also self-possessed enough, with enough confidence and trust in God, that when old King Abimelech came around and recognized this and said, "We can see that God is with you," what did Isaac do? He held a big feast. Just like we would hear thousands of years later about that father who welcomed the wayward son home with a big feast. Isaac had enough presence of mind, enough sense of abundance, that there was plenty good room for him and his neighbors. And that's something I invite us all to try to live into in small and big ways. I don't expect any of us, including myself, to have the equanimity or the wisdom to do that in every moment. But I do believe we can all work on it. We can all work on being our better selves. We can always be looking at what is the big picture, what is the God's eye view of what's going on right now. And we can lean into the prayer that those of us in recovery know so well. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen.